Hi. It's Friday. This is the takeaway for June 2nd, 2017.
The United States will cease all implementation of the non-binding Paris Accord.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. That's one small step for international trade, and it was one giant lead foot for global environmental policy yesterday. Speaking from the White House Rose Garden, President Trump announced his decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement. The voluntary agreement represented some hard-won common ground between China and the United States and was a signature achievement of the Obama administration. But the president mostly poked fun at that yesterday.
At what point does America get demeaned? At what point do they start laughing at us as a country? We want fair treatment for its citizens. And we want fair treatment for our taxpayers. We don't want other leaders and other countries laughing at us anymore. And they won't be. They won't be.
There was considerable reaction from world leaders. French President Emmanuel Macron chose to speak in French and English. He wasn't laughing, and he told the American people directly not to expect some new agreement, despite what the U.S. president was saying.
I call on you to remain confident. We will succeed. Because we are fully committed. Because wherever we live, whoever we are, we all share the same responsibility. Make our planet great again.
A hubris Danish Prime Minister Lars Rasmussen tweeted, "It's a sad day for the world." And Prime Minister Theresa May, quote, expressed her disappointment with the decision and stressed that the UK remained committed to the Paris Agreement. In his remarks, President Trump said his heart is with the people who elected him, not a bunch of foreigners.
I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris.
But Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto noted yesterday that the city voted majority Democratic, not Republican. Quote, the United States joined Syria, Nicaragua, and Russia, the mayor said, in deciding not to participate with the world's Paris Agreement. It's now up to cities to lead, he said. Policy analysts, world leaders, and corporate heads disputed virtually every job number the president cited yesterday, his energy calculations, and how much this would all cost the U.S. and benefit the supposedly laughing rest of the 195 nations in the agreement. Joining me now is Christine Todd Whitman, former governor of New Jersey from 1994 to 01, and EPA administrator under President George W. Bush from 01 to 2003. She said she wasn't very surprised by the president's announcement yesterday.
Well, he sent all the signals that said he was going to do it, and particularly in his budget and all the cuts to EPA, so I wasn't terribly surprised. And then yesterday when he reversed himself on moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, that said to me he's absolutely going to get out of Paris, because that was one promise he backed off on for his base, and so he had to offset it with another one. So I was not surprised at the final decision.
Does he perceive that backing away from Paris is a low-hanging fruit, is an easy one for him compared with some of these others, like the moving of the Jerusalem embassy, NAFTA, TPP, that sort of thing?
Yes, I think this one was an easy one for him. And the way he described it yesterday in his speech in the Rose Garden, you can understand why. I mean, his speech was inaccurate in many, many ways, particularly the number of jobs that would be lost. In fact, it can be a job creator. The statistics he was using from a study were from a study that had been largely debunked. But he certainly made a compelling argument if you believe all the statistics that he was putting out there.
Toward the end of his remarks, the president seemed to suggest that the money being used to partially pay this $3 billion commitment was, in fact, I think he used the word, robbed from our money to fight terrorism in the United States. What was your reaction to that?
Money is fungible. You can claim that money spent on anything was taken from whatever program you love and you don't think has enough money. It was not taken from that. He's proposing to take a lot of money from a lot of programs that help a lot of people, and you know, you could come after them for that. So that's not where it came from.
You seem to suggest, based on your experience, and you have direct experience with this, that nations are inclined to be very happy that the U.S. was joining a cooperative consensus on climate change, whereas Trump characterized that is, in fact, they were laughing at us. Do you think that perhaps the opposite is true, that they're more inclined to laugh at us after they get over calculating the negatives that perhaps this agreement will or this decision will produce?
Well, a lot of them are in shock. They just are saying, what has happened to the United States? Because what we've done, John, is effectively taken ourselves off the world stage as a leader. And in spite of all the ups and downs that we've had, the rest of the world, particularly the democratic nations, look to the United States. They need a strong United States. They wanted to see us as a leader. And we're basically saying, look, science says this is a big problem. You all think this is a big problem. We don't. So goodbye. We don't have a place at the table anymore. And we're not going to be able to influence not just discussions and policies vis-a-vis climate, but we're losing ground every which way. And nature abhors a vacuum. China has already stepped up and said to the European Union, we're going to start even more negotiations to get us to this place. We are going to take leadership. We're going to develop the new technologies. We're going to be the ones that are going to sell them. And I think that this actually could have an adverse effect very directly on American businesses, even though they might be doing the right thing, because many of them are. And what the others are going to say is, I'm sorry, you're from the United States. We're going to put a tariff on anything you import.
What do you say to people who say, oh, gosh, Christine Todd Whitman, she, like Nancy Pelosi, misread the American people on this question of climate change? They may put it down on their bucket list of stuff they'd love to see happen sometime before they die, but they're certainly not going to go to the voting booth and make any decision based on climate change if it means the loss of jobs, and that you're misreading the domestic politics in the United States.
Well, first of all, that's the wrong analogy. You don't lose jobs. Between 1990 and 2008, in the United States of America, our population grew by over 20%. Our use of energy grew by over 35%. We more than doubled our actual GDP, and yet we reduced our six criteria pollutants by over 67%. We did an amazing job of cutting pollution while growing our economy. So this idea that you cannot have a clean and green environment and a healthy, thriving economy is just wrong. And in fact, the other side is what's right, is that you cannot have a thriving economy without a healthy lifestyle for people. We lose 200,000 people a year who die from in this country from dirty airborne related causes. That alone should make us want to address these issues. Carbon, mercury, those are pollutants. And those are part of greenhouse gases. If we adjust it and look at the issue that way from a direct human health impact, never mind these ever-increasing, ever more severe storms that we're seeing, which no good scientist will say that particular storm was because of climate change, but this is what they tell you to expect. We've got a host of reasons why we should want to take steps to reduce our polluting.
Christine Todd Whitman was governor of New Jersey from 1994 to 2001 and EPA administrator under President George W. Bush from 01 to 2003, now president of the Whitman Strategy Group. Christine Todd Whitman, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to talk to you again.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, the former CEO and chairman of ExxonMobil, was among those in the president's cabinet who advised against his decision to leave the Paris Accord. Exxon has been a champion of new energy technologies like low-emission fuels and carbon capture. What is the corporate view of a decision like this? Well, Alice Korngold, president of Korngold Consulting, who advises companies like Dow Chemical and Johnson Controls, says there's no one answer, but based on her extensive research, companies are way out ahead of the government on this one.
Companies are driven by markets, by the marketplace, and supply and demand. And the marketplace is demanding innovation and solutions for climate change. The research for my book has shaped my thinking, actually altered my thinking about companies and their roles in solving global problems. When I finished all the research, what shocked me was a conclusion, and I finished the writing in 2013, that only multinational corporations can solve our greatest challenges. It actually kind of stunned me. But what I realized from the research is that companies are responding, are dealing with market forces. They have the global footprint and they have the vast resources.
So far from being a progressive, pro-corporate decision to pull out of the climate agreement, in fact, the Trump agreement would represent something that is not only at odds with the consensus that you found among private sector companies who are working with nonprofits, it just further places the government outside of the problem-solving sector in this particular instance.
Exactly. Companies have many stakeholders, so investors, customers, which sometimes other industries and other companies, employees, communities, nonprofits. So they have many stakeholders that they have to address. And the companies that are succeeding are the ones that are innovating and finding solutions. Our pulling out of the Paris Agreement puts U.S. companies in jeopardy with regard to trade. The EU and China could issue tariffs and other obstacles to trade. We will be at a loss in terms of innovation, with the White House already cutting back in investing in research through NASA and the EPA. Companies have been on a steady march to energy efficiency, renewable energy. It's cost effective, and it's the best investment of their infrastructure for the long term and the future. So this decision creates obstacles for companies.
Finally, it's one thing for Rex Tillerson, former CEO of Exxon in the energy business, to talk about this agreement, and some other people like Elon Musk to be critical. He's, in a business that falls kind of directly into the middle of all of this. But what does it say that the CEO of Disney, Bob Iger, has essentially distanced himself from Donald Trump?
I think any company that deals in the global marketplace understands that global market forces are driving their strategies. And whether it's cars or chemicals or any other
theme parks.
Yeah. Whatever it is, and every industry relies on energy, companies will need to be addressing the interests and regulations in countries worldwide. And we are now the outlier. And it's like car manufacturers. They're selling cars around the world. They're not going to suddenly manufacture fuel-inefficient cars because we're pulled out of the Paris Agreement.
Alice Korngold is president of Korngold Consulting. She advises companies like Dow Chemical and Johnson Controls. Author of the book she referenced, A Better World Incorporated, How Companies Profit by Solving Global Problems Where Governments Cannot. Thanks so much, Alice.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be on your show.
One curious note at the beginning of the Trump speech yesterday, I don't know if you caught it, was his somber reference to the people of the Philippines and its victims of terror. If you had to rush to find out what he was talking about, you weren't alone. A lone gunman who caused chaos at a casino in Manila was being hunted as the president was speaking, but authorities weren't calling it terror. They aren't even sure of what to make of the incident today. Reacting to recent incidents of unrest, Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte has declared martial law on the southern island of Mindanao, and President Trump, already expressing warm personal support, reportedly, for Duterte, used this Paris Accord announcement to further express his sympathy for the Asian nation's struggles with drugs and terrorism.
I would like to begin by addressing the terrorist attack in Manila. We're closely monitoring the situation.
Aurora Almendral is a reporter and radio producer based in Manila. She was on the scene yesterday at Resorts World Casino.
I was certainly surprised to hear it, because the idea that this was a terror attack had not been confirmed yet by the police or any other officials that were involved in the operation at Resorts World Casino. I think a lot of Filipinos who were awake at the time of the incident rushed to believe that this might be related to the Islamic State activities that are happening in southern Mindanao. So maybe they were a bit less surprised because of the ongoing issues with Islamic State-affiliated groups in Mindanao. But again, at the moment, the police are saying that this was a lone gunman acting on his own, and just called him a deranged individual with perhaps robbery motives or other motives that were not related to Islamic terrorism.
In the Philippines today, people are learning of this stack of 36 bodies on the site of the resort's casino. What's the response there?
I think a lot of people are very shocked. The shooting unfolded over several hours overnight in the Philippines, and there was a lot of fear that it was related to Islamic terrorism. There was quite a lot of panic in Resorts World. People were calling their family members in panic. A lot of people who were on the second and third floor were jumping down, injuring themselves, breaking ankles and legs. And there was quite a bit of panic for several hours. And I was on the scene all night, really. And I was surprised to find out that 36 people died of suffocation. Up until this morning when they recovered the bodies, they were not confirming any deaths at all. So I personally was surprised that that many people had died, and I think a lot of Filipinos as well.
So the deaths could have been related to the police response, the delay in the police response, the response at the casino itself by the authorities, not necessarily a direct result of gunman attacks.
So far, the police haven't found any of the dead to have gunshot wounds, and this is something that the Philippine police chief has said, is that this is unlikely to be terrorism because he was not opening fire on people. In fact, they said he was saying "get out" in English to the people inside the casino. What happened is that he doused gambling tables and carpets in the casino in gasoline and lit them on fire, and the combustibility of the furniture and the carpet and the windows and doors that wouldn't open led to the 36 people suffocating from the smoke.
Certainly no one would downplay the brutality of crime in Manila at a casino like this. Do you think that this incident served to be an opportunity for President Trump to declare a closer relationship with President Duterte? And for Duterte's part, was it an opportunity for him to declare martial law in Mindanao, something he's wanted to do across the entire nation since he took office?
I believe that as the events were unfolding, a lot of people feared that this would be the opportunity that would give Duterte a chance to declare martial law beyond Mindanao and into Manila and the rest of the Philippines. But at the moment, because it seems that the gunman was not related to terror attack, then he may not declare martial law. As for the time being, the police are saying that this is a lone gunman acting on his own, although that, in truth, hasn't been confirmed yet. And I heard the police chief in an interview very early this morning at around 6 a.m. say that if it does turn out that the gunman was related to terrorists, then they may have to consider martial law. Though at the moment, there has been no talk of that happening quite yet.
Although Rukmini Kalamanchi of the New York Times, who covers ISIS, has suggested that there's certainly a lot of activity on some ISIS-known websites responding to this, although not claiming responsibility. Aurora Almendral is a reporter and radio producer based in Manila. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Cleveland Cavaliers star LeBron James has had better weeks, it's probably fair to say. Besides losing to the Golden State Warriors in Game 1 of the NBA Finals by more than 20 points last night, the basketball legend held a news conference earlier this week ahead of the NBA Finals, addressing the culprit who spray-painted the N-word on the front gate of a home he owns in Los Angeles.
No matter how much money you have, no matter how famous you are, no matter how many people admire you, you know, being black in America is tough.
In his words, James expressed hope that this would shed a light and keep the conversation going about dealing with racism in America. Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, reacts.
LeBron James was targeted, I believe, not only because of his fame, not only because of his immense cultural capital, which I would argue is on par with any active athlete in the United States, but also because he has been outspoken. And it's really not surprising, as you're seeing all of these other horrific things happen in the United States, from the murders in Portland and College Park, Maryland, to the finding of a noose at the Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture, that you would see an athlete of LeBron's stature targeted as well. It really does feel like all of a package.
How moved were you by the news conference? I mean, he didn't have to do it. He could have just issued a statement.
Well, there was a moment where I went from just saying, wow, I'm really glad he did this, to my jaw hitting the floor and the sort of chills going up my back. And that was when he talked about Emmett Till.
And I think back to Emmett Till's mom, actually. It's kind of one of the first things I thought of. And the reason that she had a open casket is because she wanted to show the world what her son went through as far as a hate crime and, you know, being black in America.
You know, basically saying that if there's one good to come out of this, it's maybe that the publicity it'll get in white America, in mainstream America, the people will see that, like, hey, this is what I have to deal with.
How much do you think this relates, if at all, to the Clippers situation of a couple of years ago?
Oh, profound. And I've spoken to a lot of NBA players about this. And there's kind of a conventional reading that it was the Black Lives Matter movement and the killing of young black men and women by police that led more NBA players to speaking out. But when you talk to NBA players, it really starts with Donald Sterling. And it starts with Donald Sterling being forced out as an owner of the LA Clippers. And Donald Sterling being racist was something that was the open secret in the NBA for decades. And for decades, NBA players kind of grimaced and bore it. And then when they were finally able, with both a new commissioner and with audio of Donald Sterling going public, where he expressed his racism, it gave players this sense of, we don't have to be passive when we see these kinds of things, that we actually have some power. I think there's a direct line between that and LeBron James feeling today that he can do something more than just issue a press release.
And I would just say, as a LeBron fan and, you know, listening to sports radio for the last 3 months, try to figure out where he sits in the top 10 list, driving me crazy. There's something totally special about LeBron. And today, you know, this week's events really show that.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, people often compare him to Michael Jordan, particularly their outspokenness or Jordan's lack thereof. And I think what's often forgotten is that Michael Jordan grew up in a very stable middle class home in Wilmington, North Carolina. And LeBron James's mom was 16 when he was born, and they spent part of his life living in a car. I mean, remember, he's only 32. I mean, we're not talking about some kind of distant past. I mean, the memories of poverty and hunger are a part of who he is. And I really think that creates a different kind of mindset when he looks at the question of community and the question of what his accountability is within that community.
Dave Zirin, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
The way I see it, you and me got one thing to talk about. And that's what you are willing to do for me.
You should reward me accordingly.
Which bothers some men. The word itself makes some men uncomfortable.
I volunteer as tribute.
Stick with me and we'll claw our way to the top.
Well, there's a first time for everything.
Many things to talk about with Rafer Guzman. It's movie time on this Friday. Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday and The Takeaway. Captain Underpants, the first epic movie. I'm kind of surprised this is the first. It seems like it's taken a while for them to start this franchise. Virtually everything else has started from children's books. Some thoughts and a clip we'll have?
Yeah. It's been 20 years since the first Captain Underpants movie came out. George and Harold, the two fourth grade kids who draw Captain Underpants comics and then hypnotize their principal, Mr. Krupp, into becoming their favorite superhero, Captain Underpants with wedgie power.
You're trapped in some sort of invisible box-like prison. What's that? I can't hear you. But I see your tears.
Is it okay that I'm kind of loving this?
Yes and no, but mostly yes.
Fear not. I will set you free.
Ow! Ow!
What is wrong with you? Oh, that's better. I can hear you now.
The longest wedgie scene in the history of cinema.
That's Captain Underpants encountering his first mime.
This is totally animated or partially animated?
Totally animated. Great voice cast. Ed Helms plays Captain Underpants there. Kevin Hart and also Thomas Middleditch play the two kids. You know, my kids are fans of these books. They've got them all. And I think this movie does a really good job of capturing that sort of gonzo, crazy spirit that the books have. I also think what's nice about it is it kind of deepens the friendship between the two boys. And that's something that's only hinted at in the books. And it works well here for a movie. And I was actually really pleased with this. I think kids are really going to enjoy this movie.
And there's the happy thought that Ed Helms' young child, I believe, knows what he does for a living. Must know Captain Underpants.
I guess that's right.
Doesn't know the Hangover movies.
Probably not. What could be a better gift than to become Captain Underpants?
The blockbuster this summer is expected to be Wonder Woman. The cast, Chris Pine, is familiar. What about the others?
Well, Gal Gadot, Israeli actress who plays Wonder Woman. This is her big debut. It's her starring role in her standalone movie, Wonder Woman. First real big-budget summer tentpole superhero movie with a woman at the center. Also the first to be directed by a woman, Patty Jenkins.
Unfortunately, I have another matter to attend to. What? You
will soon find out.
You are still no match for me.
We'll see about that.
The question is, how does Wonder Woman in the movies distinguish herself from Superman, other superheroes, to be to emphasize the woman rather than the wonder?
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the great interesting things about this film is the fact that it flips all these stereotypes on their heads without ever making too big a deal about it. You know, you remember Wonder Woman came from an all-female island of Amazon warriors. Mm-hmm. And so you see that typical scene that we've seen so many times before where the young boy wants to join the soldiers and train in battle and swing his sword around. This time it's a woman. And this time all the generals are women. Robin Wright plays one of the generals in this movie. And so you see this young girl get to play that role. She wants to join the action, be a warrior, be brave, and get in the fray. The film doesn't make a big deal about that, but it works so beautifully. And everything in this film, I think, works that way. It's a first that doesn't in some ways make a big deal about being a first, if you know what I mean.
Chris Pine holds a tambourine and plays a backup singer?
Yeah, he's the Art Garfunkel of the film. No, he's not. He's actually really great. He's playing an American soldier who crash lands near Wonder Woman's island, and the two of them go off to fight World War I. You know, she was originally created in the comic books to be a World War II heroine, but here it's World War I, which I think actually works really well.
Romantic connection?
Very romantic, funny. To me, I think a real crowd pleaser. I think the big question will be, will young boys want to go see this movie? That's going to be what drives this movie, I think.
Wonder Woman and Captain Underpants, two positives for the weekend. Have a great weekend, Rafer Guzman.
Thanks, John. You too.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Nearly a quarter of the people diagnosed in the U.S. with mental illness in the absence of traditional medical services are likely to have encounters with law enforcement, which has meant that an estimated 2 million people with varying degrees of psychological illness are in prison, some ill before their incarceration, others become ill inside prison, in institutions where there are scant resources for treatment. In New York City, most of the mentally ill inmates from Rikers Island are treated at Bellevue Hospital, where psychiatrists treat patients dealing with their sentences, isolation and stigma, and the oppressive, relentless environment of a crowded prison. Dr. Elizabeth Ford is the chief of psychiatry for Correctional Health Services for New York City's health and hospitals. She became a prison psychiatrist after moonlighting at Bellevue Hospital to pay off some student loans and saw that the prison population was grossly underserved when it came to mental health assistance. She's the author of Sometimes Amazing Things Happen: Heartbreak and Hope on the Bellevue Hospital Psychiatric Prison Ward. It's a memoir of her experiences as a correctional psychiatrist working with patients and inmates.
I had been told that all these patients lie and they just try to do everything to get out of jail. But in fact, they were quite honest. They were very compassionate with me, which is also something I didn't expect. And they were very sick, like very sick. And many of them had never had a doctor, period. And of those who have had a doctor or a psychiatrist, many of them had not had good experiences.
And if we enlarge this to include all of the prisons in the United States. This is where we treat the mentally ill in America, and the need is catastrophically infinite.
Yeah, I think catastrophically infinite is probably the appropriate way to describe it. Part of the journey and part of really what I wanted to share with others is that in the midst of all that like endless well of need, there are little pockets of hope. There's pockets of success. I mean, there are little tiny interactions that I would never have thought would make a difference. One sort of very compelling example to me is during Hurricane Sandy. There were 61 patients who joined together, I mean, literally in all sorts of ways to get through that, to work with each other. There were patients who had been fighting the day prior who were helping each other get water, get clean linens, dealing with their stress. And that, I think, maybe was a very pivotal moment for me in terms of seeing the real potential of what can happen in a system like this.
Over 5 or 6 decades, the idea of institutional treatment for the mentally ill has been, you know, denigrated. Mm-hmm. Mass release was the sort of policy of the 70s. The consequence of that is that these people have found their way back into other institutions called prisons. Your book, in a strange way, makes a case for an institutional setting that would work, even though you're not regressive in any way. You're not a throwback.
I'm glad you brought that up, because the idea of what's the best setting for these kinds of patients is extraordinarily complicated, and I don't have the answer. I struggle with that. I'm not advocating for going back to that. I'm certainly not advocating for the incarceration, the mass incarceration of people with serious mental illness. But I think you're very correct that some of the work, some of the successes, some of the ability to form relationships with these patients that I've had have been in institutional settings. And I don't really know how to reconcile that yet.
What would you say is a feature of the punishment system in the criminal justice system that bears most heavily on your work as a psychiatrist?
The policy decisions that have had the most impact, at least on the patients that I treated at Bellevue, really had to do with mandatory sentences. And I had a number of patients, one of whom I talk about in the book, who had been sentenced under the Rockefeller drug laws. When those were repealed and he was able to be resentenced and probably released because he had already been in for a decade, he was too sick to come before the judge to get resentenced. And there was nothing written into the law to allow him to actually get out. Within the system that I work in now, the jail system, you can get arrested while you are in jail or prison for things called infractions. And sometimes those are inconsistently enforced, hard to understand. They can be very different from how you behave out in the community. And so for people with mental illness particularly, it can be hard to know how to behave correctly so that that doesn't happen to you.
And the infractions pile up.
That was my experience when I was at Bellevue, that I treated a number of patients who had accumulated thousands of days of solitary confinement. But there have been some major reforms. They're called box days. They don't accumulate like that anymore. And for the patients I treat, that's an enormous improvement.
Will we ever make a decision as a society how we want to treat the mentally ill?
As a society, and frankly, I'm going to also speak as a psychiatrist, I don't think we understand mental illness. Definitely not in the same way as we understand diabetes or hypertension. And I do worry that if we don't try to understand it in a real nitty-gritty from the patient's perspective, I don't know if we ever will understand it in a way that can really shift public opinion about it.
You had a close-up view of how the institutions you work for actually, in certain instances, make people sick. Yeah. What was that like to experience as a physician?
Well, for me, it was almost catastrophic. I mean, there was a point where I actually had to quit. And also to recognize that a lot of my work is not specifically how do I find the correct medication for this person with schizophrenia, but how do I help this person be safe and not get worse in a system that's chaotic and traumatic. I mean, it's hard, but the rewards are enormous. Sometimes people need guidance and sort of a little faith in terms of where to find those rewards.
Well, your title is Sometimes Amazing Things Happen. What's the characteristic story?
A patient who I describe in various points in the book came into the system a black man who believed with all of his heart that he was white. And his particular challenge was that he would try to peel off his skin. He was delusional about this belief. You could not convince him otherwise. And he was really hurting himself. So I treated him and we developed this relationship. And by the end, he was taking his medication. He was no longer delusional. He even spoke about his beliefs from years ago and how he hoped that those didn't return. And then eventually, I actually saw him out in the community and he had a baby. He was on the cusp of getting a job and he had a place to live.
So sometimes amazing things happen. It's a set of amazing stories, Heartbreak and Hope on the Bellevue Hospital Psychiatric Prison Ward, the book by Dr. Elizabeth Ford. She's chief of psychiatry for correctional health services for New York City's health and hospitals. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
100 years ago, the first commercial recording of jazz was released. The single was called Tiger Rag. That track was recorded in 1917 by the original Dixieland Jazz Band, J-A-S-S, a group of white entertainers from New Orleans. Today, Tiger Rag ranks among the most recorded compositions in the American Songbook. Jazz recordings, J-A-Z-Z, reflected the black roots of what Wynton Marsalis would eventually call America's classical music. Joan Schaefer is host of WNYC's Soundcheck and New Sounds, and he caught up with New Orleans-born trumpeter Christian Scott Atunde Adjua to learn that this first white record has influenced or bothered generations of jazz musicians, including himself, and he wanted to tell that story in words and music.
There really is that one landmark moment 100 years ago when one single came out and was met with kind of mixed reviews, let's say, by the American public. But it was a start. And it was from New Orleans, as you might expect, and a band called the Original Dixieland Jazz Band.
Jazz.
Jazz. J-A-S-S.
And what did jazz mean?
Well, see, nobody really knows where the word jazz came from anyway. And it seems like there were these two spellings, the two S's or the two Z's. However, one of the people marking the centennial of the first recording of jazz is the trumpeter Christian Scott, who records under the name Christian Scott Atunde Adjua. And he is from New Orleans, and I asked him what he thought about this original Dixieland jazz band.
Like when I was a little boy, if you said jazz in front of my grandmother, my great-grandmother, you could get a bloody mouth. Like they'd view this was a very pejorative term. Jazz music was seen as J-A-S-S or jackass music.
You know, this was really music that had come from a community that was not considered to be part of the high art of the burgeoning American culture. And again, to go back to the trumpeter Christian Scott, that's part of the reason why there was such a mixed reaction to this record.
The older musicians, they had negative feelings about this original recording because apparently it was really satire, right? It was something that was supposedly made as a joke.
So within this community of players of popular music, there's racial tension, and the commercial recording reflects that.
It seems to. It's almost as if this is a way of saying, hey, America, look what the black musicians are doing down in New Orleans. So if you listen again to that Tiger Rag, you know, the little whee, whee, it's almost got a kind of Spike Jones connotation to it. You know, it almost sounds like a musical joke.
And certainly none of the reverential qualities that, say, a Wynton Marsalis would deliver in talking about Dixieland, particularly the New Orleans music that he comes from because he's a New Orlean.
And you know, none of the incredible emotive soloing that you would get just a few years later from people like Louis Armstrong. Now, the interesting thing about the original Dixieland jazz band from New Orleans is how quickly they cottoned on to the idea that there might be something here that was not a joke. So they moved to New York. They changed the spelling of the name to J-A-Z-Z and went on to become one of the hottest bands here in New York in the early 1920s. And, you know, the French were listening. The Europeans as a whole were really interested in this new form of music coming from the United States. And in fact, the thing that sort of got me looking at this whole centenary was an exhibition here in New York at the Cooper Hewitt Museum called The Jazz Age, which really looks at how jazz sort of sparked a whole explosion of different forms of culture here in the United States. And their curator, Sarah Coffin, basically puts that down to the European response to these early records.
Particularly as the French, they were so enthusiastic about it, that this led to Americans who thought that everything French was chic, appreciating something in their own culture that they hadn't thought to look at the time.
Did World War I mix the pot, as it were, culturally?
That's actually a really good question because James Reese Europe, who was the first kind of ambassador of jazz, he was really responsible for bringing the sounds of jazz, live jazz, to Europe and really creating this audience for this new form of music. And of course, he got his introduction to those people through the First World War. So once the war ends, James Reese Europe is bringing his band back to Europe, where he has found something in the atmosphere that suggests to him that he might have a receptive audience. And boy, does that prove to be the case.
So what is this an occasion for Christian Scott, or as he records under Tunde Ajua, to do?
Well, he is marking the centenary of the first recordings of jazz, despite the mixed feelings, by releasing a trilogy of records, one of which, Ruler Rebel, is already out. And each album gets a little bit further into the kind of identity politics of being black in America. So, for example, the final record, which will be issued later this year, is called The Emancipation Procrastination, the idea that a process that was begun over 150 years ago is still just that, a process, and one that is unfolding perhaps too slowly.
Well, here's a cut from that series called The Reckoning.
And you're listening to that song by Christian Scott. You can hear the influence of modern electronica, the brand of Atlanta-style hip-hop known as trap music. I mean, the same thing, that DNA is definitely woven into the fabric of what he does.
This thing happens every, 30 to 40 years, you get a new birth of some kind. But I think there's something in the water. I think there's something definitely happening again right now, even though we're at this landmark of 100 years. I don't necessarily know that the new sound is going to come specifically out of jazz, but we like to think that we'll have a part of it.
John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck and New Sounds. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So much in there. The past, present, and the future. Hard to believe. Recorded jazz is 100 years old. Of course, the roots of jazz go far, far beyond a century ago. That's all for us today. As always, we want your take on all of this. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. If you want to take The Takeaway with you, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.